This is Jim Zetzer, your host of the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barron, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays. And I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You can, that is, unless he's off in Morocco trying to track down one of those alleged suicide hijackers. He speaks fluent French and Arabic. And, of course, he's a convert to Islam. And I think if anyone can pull off this stunt, it's going to be Kevin. So I look forward to hopefully even having him on the show so we can talk about what he's discovered while he's over there. Now, my guest for today, Don Paul, had a conflict, so he notified me this morning that he couldn't make it. So while I had looked forward to talking to him about, for example, the San Diego grand jury investigation, where he played a crucial role, and other aspects of the development of 9/11 research, I won't be able to have him for some time due to his work commitment. So instead, I'm going to discuss a variety of issues, and I'm also going to welcome phone calls. So if anyone would like to call in today, the number for call-ins is 1-800-259-5791. Area code 1-800-259-5791. Now, the place I'm going to begin is with an article in the New York Times today, Thursday, May 17th, about unfriendly views on U.S.-backed Arabic TV. Where some politicians have been upset because this station that is the United States is supporting and funding, Al-Hura, A-L-H-U-R-R-A, has been broadcasting the views of some parties that are critical to the United States. And these politicians are upset. Now, here we're talking about, of course, credibility and propaganda. Propaganda occurs when you suppress information that might, you know, ought to make a difference to one's attitude or point of view towards something. The Hurrah executive, Joachim F. Malaya, testified that network officials made sure to question the Arabic-speaking staff about what went on the air. So some of them obviously don't even speak Arabic, so it's going to be kind of hard to monitor what's going out on your Arabic-speaking station if you don't speak Arabic. Mr. Balaya and State Department officials acknowledged that the speech by the Hezbollah leader, this is what had caused all this concern, the Hezbollah leader, Sheikh Nasrallah, violated the network's policy not to give a platform to those Washington considers to be terrorists. Okay? So here you got a guy who's expressing views, and he's, according to Washington, supposed to be a terrorist. Of course, how Washington decides who's a terrorist and who's not a terrorist is very much the way they decide who's a freedom fighter and not a freedom fighter. If people are getting slaughtered, but for, you know, in ways that are going to promote the interests of the United States and the freedom fighters, if they're slaughtering people in ways that don't promote U.S. interests or actively oppose them, then they're terrorists. But Mr. Balaya contended in an interview Wednesday that Al-Hura would lose all credibility if it not give airtime to people who disagreed with American policy. He said that complaints about airtime for Mr. Hamia were unjustified because he legitimately holds the post of Palestinian Prime Minister. So they weren't going to put on the Palestinian Prime Minister because the United States doesn't like his point of view. How absurd can that be? Mr. Blaya also said it was ironic that the government was seeking to promote American values like democracy and a free press while at the same time trying to censure what is shown in the station. That's the difference between a free media and propaganda, he said, and how well he is right to say that, okay? When you suppress inquiry and the exchange of views, you're engaging in propaganda. It's something the Soviets did. It's not something I would have presumed the United States wants to emulate. And what I found so ironic reading that article is that it struck me that much of what goes on in 9/11 research today is operating on a similar principle, that there's a prevailing view here within the 9/11 research community that's committed to a certain way of looking at the issues related to 9/11, and that it's actively operating to suppress alternative views. I received a fascinating email from a member of our audience making some key points about this, where I was talking about in passing with Peggy Carter yesterday about how one way to contain 9/11 research is to define its boundaries very narrowly and then encourage very active research within those very narrow boundaries. in this case, that amounts to creating boundaries around the idea that thermite or thermate was involved in the destruction of the buildings on 9/11. And to my utter astonishment, some of those who promote this theory still describe the destruction of the buildings as a collapse, as opposed to a pulverization, when we have overwhelming photographic evidence illustrating vividly that the buildings were pulverized and that masses of the concrete and the steel in those buildings was turned to very fine dust, not to mention the furniture, the desks, the chairs, the computers, the human beings and other living things. Don't forget, 1,100 bodies were never recovered. 1,100 bodies were never recovered. Those were bodies that were turned into very fine dust, never recovered. That's completely inconsistent with a collapse, even involving explosives, where you expect to find body parts, even if they were detached from bodies. And you'd find lots of skulls and torsos and arms and legs, but here we're talking about 1,100 bodies, no parts of which were recovered. This is stunning stuff, and it certainly implies that something was going on here far beyond the use of any kind of merely conventional explosives. But what's going on in the research community is an attempt to constrain research that would actually have the capacity potentially to explain what's going on by reaching beyond conventional weaponry into the range of unconventional weaponry, such as lasers, masers, plasmoids, mini-nukes. I mean, who knows in advance of actually conducting investigation that theories or hypotheses about the use of lasers or masers or mini-nukes are wrong? You can't know that without investigation. And I'm going to suggest that a gigantic hoax is being perpetrated on the research community by the claim that scientific method supports this very narrow definition of the use of thermite and thermate. Well, I've now taken a good look at the latest paper that's been produced by the leading proponent of that view, Stephen Jones, and it doesn't add up. I mean, it may be impressive to those who are naive about the nature of science, who are incapable of reading a paper that has the least degree of technical sophistication to it. But I'm going to suggest to you when I go through this paper that what we have here is a rather elaborate snow job, where the most important points made are actually concessions that the evidence that he has found is merely consistent with the use of thermite and thermate, but doesn't prove it was produced by thermite or thermate, where provided that there are multiple alternative possible explanations, he has not done the job. And I'm going to claim that he has not done the job because he has a commitment to a conception of scientific method that is hopelessly inadequate, hopelessly inadequate. And that while he talks a lot about science, he is, alas, not practicing it. Now, you have to bear in mind that we find this in many different professional fields, like medicine and law. How many times do we find, here's a physician who's been practicing medicine in some rural community for years, and he doesn't have a license, never went to med school. Sometimes the community like him so much, they want to keep him in spite of that. Or a lawyer who's practicing without a license. There are frauds and quacks across the board, and some of them call themselves scientists. We'll be right back. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today I'm talking about scientific research in relation to 9/11 and the desire or the tendency to restrict the range of investigation so that, in fact, the true hypothesis, what actually happened, may be excluded from consideration from scratch on the basis of some kind of ideological or propagandistic reasoning that is very cleverly contrived, but ultimately can be exposed. Now, based upon some remarks I made yesterday about the way in which the research community can be contained, and I mentioned two ways. One is the passivity approach, where you have meetings and you watch videos, but you never have debate, discussion, or take any actions. That's one way of containing a 9/11 research movement, converted into a passive mode of operation. People will come, they'll be motivated, they may be idealistic, energetic, full of ideas, but they're going to be turned off by this passivity of merely watching DVDs, hearing things over and over, stuff they may have already figured out for themselves, because that's why they were motivated to get into the movement. It becomes boring and tedious, uninteresting, and ultimately accomplishes nothing. And that might seem very strange unless your objective is to control the movement by having meetings that are tedious and boring and uninteresting that accomplish nothing because you want to accomplish nothing. So that's one modus operandi in relation to activism. The other modus operandi of disinformation in relation to, research, here thereby dividing the issue in terms of these two different modes of operation that apply, one to activism and the other to research, is to artificially constrain or contrive the range of hypotheses that are under consideration. I experienced this up close and personal when I did research into the death of Senator Paul Wellstone, whose plane crashed on 25 October 2002. It was just about 10 days before the election. He'd been climbing out to a 7, 8, or 9-point lead after giving a speech denouncing the Bush administration with regard to the war on Iraq. And as I got deeper and deeper into doing research on this subject, I discovered that the NTSB's own investigation was a charade, because it turns out that unless the Attorney General declares a crash scene to be a crime scene, that it can't be investigated as a crime scene, which meant that you got a perfect mechanism here for getting rid of your political enemies, bring them down in a plane crash, and then have a complicit or compliant Attorney General declare it not to be a crime scene, and then you're constrained to investigate only accident-compatible alternatives, which is exactly what the NTSB did. So I considered the possibility that the crash was brought down by the plane, some mechanical problem, or the weather causing difficulties in flight, or by the pilot, some lack of competence. Well, the more research I did, the more implausible it became that either the plane, the pilots, or the weather were responsible. The plane was something like the Rolls-Royce, a small aircraft. It was a King Air A-100 with a marvelous maintenance history. It's a plane that practically flies itself. The weather was not bad, even though Wolf Blitzer and other national commentators were suggesting that there was snow and freezing rain. Those of us in the vicinity, and I was in Duluth at the time, and these events were taking place, so 60 miles north in the Evelyn, Virginia vicinity, knew that the weather wasn't that bad. I would eventually get photographs from a pilot on the ground who was out, because he's also in real estate, taking pictures across lakes. And not only was there no freezing rain, there wasn't even any rain. There weren't even any ripples on the surface of the water. So this was a complete charade, even though eminences like Wolf Blitzer were propagating this false information in a local anchor in Duluth by the name of Denny Anderson, who's also a pilot, was repeatedly correcting these false reports about the weather. So it turns out that neither the plane nor the weather were, remotely plausibly considered not remotely plausibly to be responsible here, which was a conclusion the NTSB would eventually reach itself when it would release its report about a year after the crash. Not the pilots. So if you got to choose between the weather, the plane, and the pilots, well, okay, if the plane's great and the weather wasn't bad, it looks like the pilots are going to be held responsible. And yet the chief pilot, Richard Connery, had 5,200 hours of experience. He had an air transport pilot's license. And he had passed his FAA flight check just 2 days before, which means by the government's own standards and given the government's own criteria of evaluation, this guy was well qualified to fly the plane. Although it's not required, there was a second pilot aboard, Michael Glatz, who had experience. He wasn't as qualified as Connery, but he was a competent pilot. And there's no reason to suppose that coming into this airport, which other pilots have told me is really very, very user-friendly, very accessible airport, that there should have been any problems. But if you were forced to choose between the plane, the pilot, and the weather, and the situation where the plane's terrific and the weather wasn't bad, you're going to gravitate toward the pilots for inexplicable reasons. And that's basically what the NTSB did. They said for inexplicable reasons, basically, that the pilots got confused or whatever, and they allowed the plane to crash. Well, I thought that was fairly ridiculous because the course of my investigation was turning up other possible causes or explanations for what had happened. But, well, it took me a long while to appreciate that the NTSB wasn't even considering them. they included, you know, based upon conjecture, speculation, and hypothesis formation right off the bat, that they could have included a gas canister or a small bomb or some kind of high-tech weapon. I mean, if you don't consider the full range of alternative possible explanations, since much of science proceeds by a process of elimination, how can you be sure if you've eliminated alternatives that the one you're left with in the end must be the truth? This is the principle that Sherlock Holmes enunciated Arthur Conan Doyle. When you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Well, if you simply sweep out all of the non-accident compatible alternatives, as the NTSB did, because the Attorney General didn't declare it to be a crime scene or even a potential crime scene, then, of course, you're going to be guaranteed you're going to have an accident-compatible alternative. And I conducted investigation on this with other scholars and experts, including a Native American scholar from Northern Arizona University, who is both a Ph.D. and an EDD. We published a book together called American Assassination, A Strange Death of Senator Paul Wellstone, and we lay out the evidence we turned up there that indicated to us that what had actually happened here was that the plane was brought down by the use of a high-tech weapon that imparted a surge of energy to the plane to overwhelm the electrical systems, called these switches, these solenoids to flip and the props to turn on to idle. I'll be right back. Jim Fetzer, this is the Dynamic Duo. I'm talking about scientific research within the 9/11 community and how it can be managed, and how, in the case of activists, how it can be contained if you adopt a passive model by bringing those who are interested in becoming activists and doing something about it to a mode of operation where you're simply watching DVDs or videos, not participating in discussion or of ideas or plans for action, so that people who come into the activist community with lots of ideas and motivation become turned off because the programs that are being conducted are boring, repetitious, and uninspiring, and nothing ever gets done. Well, that's a brilliant mode of operation if your objective is to make sure that nothing gets done. Create an environment that's boring and repetitious where people who have ideas that might motivate them to take the activist steps get turned off. And I say that's something you'd want to do deliberately if your objective was to contain 9/11 activism. That's a model for containment that applies to activism. The model of a containment that applies to research is to constrain the range of alternative hypotheses that are allowed to be investigated. Make sure it's an artificial contraction, so that, in fact, the true hypothesis isn't even included among those under active investigation. And, in fact, anyone who wanders off the reservation, who starts to explore, consider hypotheses other than those that are within the bounds of the acceptable, is viciously attacked on all kinds of ad hominem and other unscientific grounds. Masquerading, of course, as though they were science. You might even put them in a journal you claim is a peer-reviewed journal. But actually, it's operating by a group of individuals that are being mutually reinforcing. They have no critical standards. They're not actually trying to enforce the quality that would be required if this actually were a serious journal. I mean, what it's really being used is as a disinformation mechanism to constrain and control what becomes acceptable research. So that in the case of, I was offering a parallel in the case of real life events, the death of Senator Paul Wellstone in an airplane crash that happened on 25 October 2002, where the NTSB, as a matter of policy, doesn't consider any non-accident compatible alternatives unless the Attorney General declares that the scene is a crime scene or a potential crime scene. And if that doesn't happen in the absence of making such a declaration, then they're constrained to consider only accident-compatible alternatives. So one of the oddities of the case was that the props were sent out for independent investigation, and the company came back and explained they were set on idle, which is very odd. I mean, obviously, if the props are on idle, you have no forward thrust, and the plane's going to crash. So the question became, well, why were they set on idle? This was not something for which the NTSB had an explanation. They would eventually claim that the pilot simply lost control of their airspeed and altitude and allowed the plane to crash. Well, this verges on absurdity. I mean, if you're trained as a pilot, the most important element you are instructed in is always maintaining the proper altitude and speed. Otherwise, you're going to crash. So this was a, you know, this was an insulting explanation that the NTSB proposed after a year. Well, you didn't have to wait a year to hear what the FBI thought, because while the plane went down at 10:22 in the Eveleth, Virginia area, which was north of Duluth, as I mentioned already, an FBI rapid response team appears to have been on the scene as early as noon, which is fascinating. We know that because, for example, the St. Louis County Sheriff, Rick Wahlberg, encountered some of these guys he knew personally when he showed up at 1:30, and they told him they'd been there since noon. I spoke with the airport assistant manager who had discovered the plane after it didn't arrive on its schedule. And he told me he knew they'd been there at least since 1 o'clock, but he'd been so tied up with phone calls and so forth that he couldn't say how much earlier they might have shown up. So I did a calculation, a backward calculation, making the most brief times involved in getting from their original source, their offices in St. Paul, to the airport, getting aboard the plane, getting the plane in the air, flying to Duluth, renting cars, and getting up to Eveleth, Virginia. And I discovered, using the most conservative estimates, in other words, making all these things happen about as fast as they could possibly happen within remotely reasonable parameters, and I discovered for them to have arrived by noon, they had to have left St. Paul at the same time, or approximately the same time the senator's plane was taking off. So these guys must have amazing powers of prognostication that they can anticipate they're going to be needed in the Eveleth, Virginia area because of a plane crash involving a United States senator when they've taken off before the event has even occurred. Not only that, but a spokesman for the FBI would announce that day already that there was no signs of terrorist involvement. Well, I got to tell you, that plane, where the wings are the principal fuel source, the wings were broken off when the plane crashed in a wooded area. The tail was still intact, but the fuselage was burning with such intensity that the firemen were not only unable to put out the fire, they couldn't remove the bodies, and it burned intensely for some 7 hours. And it only cooled enough to be inspected the next day while they were shuffling through what remained, which was basically a pile of charcoal, and I'll tell you where you can get photographs that confirm this. Looking for the black box, did they discover the bodies? I mean, that's how completely destroyed were the bodies. Now, I say, how can the FBI be saying there was no evidence of terrorist involvement when they had no idea of the cause of the crash, which the NTSB wouldn't determine for a year? I mean, think about it. If you don't know the cause of the crash, how can you know that the cause of the crash was not something that terrorists were using? I mean, when you talk about terrorists, you're talking about people who have a certain kind of motivation. They're trying to perpetrate acts because they have a political agenda. In the case of 9/11, for example, the Bush administration appears to have had a political agenda, this neoconservative vision for an American empire that spanned the world, that needed to have support from the American people, which wouldn't occur unless they felt they were subjected to some kind of external threat by a foreign force. They needed a catalytic traumatizing event, 9/11 provided it. Well, how could you know there's no terrorist involvement in the plane crash if you don't even know what caused the plane to crash? There was a similar parallel when a fire broke out in Houston, and a reporter was, he put out a story that I read saying how they didn't know the cause of the fire at the refinery, but there were no signs of terrorist involvement. And I wrote him and said, well, how can they know there were no signs of terrorist involvement if they don't even know the cause of the crash? And he wrote back to me rather sheepishly and said he thought I had a good point. Well, it's an excellent point. You have to ask this question when you're hearing claims, you know, that are being made that may seem the least bit funny. How could they possibly know? Here the FBI was making a declaration that there were no signs of terrorist involvement, and yet no determination of the cause of the crash had been established. So how could they possibly know? Answer, they couldn't. If they couldn't possibly know, and yet they're making a declaration, then evidently something is going on other than an objective search for truth. And Carol Carmody, who was a former CIA official, but was in charge of the team from the NTSB that showed up the next day, went ahead and blandly endorsed the statement from the FBI that there were no signs of terrorist involvement, even though, as I have already observed, it would be a year before the NTSB would determine what happened. Well, my investigation was carrying me in the direction of the causes other than accidents. It was very implausible it was a plane, the pilots, or the weather. Far more plausible that something untoward had happened that might be a gas canister or... And we'll be right back with further discussion. This is your host, Jim Fetzer, on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. I was explaining how, in the course of my investigation, I was drawn in the direction of non-accident explanations, a small bomb, a gas canister, possibly some kind of high-tech weapon. And it turns out very small signs can be important clues, such as garage doors opening without using the clicker. So there were reports of garage doors that had opened that day without a clicker. Well, that's very interesting. There was a fellow who was on his way to a funeral, which was the occasion for Paul Wellstone to fly into the Eveleth, Virginia airport, who had an odd cell phone anomaly that occurred right at the time the plane was going down, right about 10:22 or so. He had a call on his phone, and it had a whirling and wavering when he answered it, a kind of loud roar, but it had a periodicity to it. It was kind of experience he'd never heard before. This was not a lack of reception, mind you. This was some phenomenon that was bringing about a recording of a weird sound, or the reception of a weird sound. So this was very strange, but it was a kind of spillover effect one might expect if, for example, some kind of high-tech or directed energy weapon had been used to overwhelm the electrical system. And, of course, we had this problem of the props being on idle. It also turns out this plane was equipped with a very sophisticated stall warning alarm. So if there was any threat that the plane was going to crash, the stall warning alarm would go off and remind the pilots that they weren't paying attention to their altitude or their airspeed, if indeed that were the case. And the idea that you'd have two pilots who are flying a United States senator's wife, daughter, and three aides would not be paying attention to what they were doing with regard to such elements as their airspeed and altitude was, in my opinion, so ridiculous that it didn't deserve to be taken seriously, and yet this was what the NTSB would be offering as its song and dance. So I conducted investigation on all this with Don Jacobs, also known as Four Arrows. We published a book about it. I made several statements about it at the National Press Club when we released the book on the 25th of October, 2004. And if you want to read the statements there, you can go to assassinationscience.com, where I maintain a public issues website. And you find the statements I gave about Paul Wellstone, quite a bit about the case. I had published, in the meanwhile, 10 columns reporting the results of my investigation as I was looking into this matter in a local alternative newspaper called the Reader Weekly. And those are all archived on that website, too. Now, in addition, after publishing the book, I continued my research, and I brought in a fellow who is also a PhD, and this time a physicist with a background in electromagnetism. And I flew him up from Australia, and we wound up tromping around the crash site at 35 below zero weather in the winter, and picking up little pieces of the debris, and ultimately analyzing them, and more importantly, going through the 2,500 pages of documents and records that were the basis for the NTSB's own report, which only ran about 80 pages. Yeah, this fellow's name is John P. Costella. He's a completely brilliant guy. I've gotten to know him in relation to research on JFK, especially with respect to the Zapruder film, where he made absolutely brilliant findings that are published in the third of my edited books, where I brought together the best qualified experts on different aspects of the case in each of the three books, called The Great Zapruder Film Hoax. And we found very subtle but devastating indications of how the film had been recreated. For technical reasons, it had to be redone to get the right sequence between the frames because there are these double images that link frames together. They're known as ghost images, and if you don't reshoot them, it's going to give away that you've altered the film. And we put this together with a whole bunch of other evidence and realized, you know, how this was done, contracting the timeline and taking out some key events, such as the driver pulling the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure Jack would be killed, during which interval he was actually hit twice in the head. So anyway, I brought up John Costella from Australia. And Costella, having far more technical competence than I, poured through these 2,500 pages, and we authored a piece about it. And the most striking result was the discovery that was buried in all these pages of a meteorological phenomenon that, in the above the crash site, that at the level where ice forms in the atmosphere, there was a huge hole of melted ice in the atmosphere. Now, the meteorologist said this was a surprising phenomenon. They had no explanation for it, but it actually fits perfectly with a directed energy weapon aimed at the plane that would take out, overwhelm the electrical system. It would shut off that sophisticated stall alarm. It would flip the solenoid switches and put the props on idle, and the plane would crash. So this was a stunning confirmation. So we wrote up what we found in these 2,500 pages in a short paper with six photographs. And it's entitled The NTSB Failed Wellstone, co-authored by me and John Costello. And while the paper is only about, as I say, it's about four pages long, and it has six photographs, and you can actually see how charred were the remnants. This is really quite fascinating. It had like 115 notes. I must believe this is the most copiously documented paper ever published in history, that is four pages with like 115 notes and six photographs. And it was published by Michael Rupert in his From the Wilderness electronic newsletter, and then also in the hardbound version of From the Wilderness. So Michael Rupert had this paper refereed and published in From the Wilderness, and you can find it online. So this is very typical of scientific research, okay? What you have to do, you have a puzzling phenomenon. You don't know what's going on. You can't explain it. Doesn't fit into your background knowledge. You have to open your mind to speculation about the full range of alternative possible explanations. This is an absolutely crucial step. If you cut it off, the way in which the NTSB cut it off, so they only considered accident-compatible alternatives, then you may never consider what actually turns out to be the true explanation. Then you have to adapt the hypothesis to the evidence. You have to figure out what's the probability of the evidence if each of these different hypotheses were true. And you've got to make sure your evidence is authentic. In the case of JFK, we discovered that most, not just some, but most of the evidence in relation to JFK was not authentic. And that once you sorted out the difference between the authentic and the inauthentic evidence, it was relatively straightforward to figure out what had happened. For example, that the man was shot four times. In the throat, from in front, from the back, 5.5 inches below the collar, from behind, and twice in the head during that interval when the vehicle was pulled to the left. That Connolly was hit at least once as many as three times, and that there were three shots that missed, one injury in a distant bystander, one injury, one damage in a chrome strip over the limousine windshield, another in the grass. So there were actually 8, 9, or 10 shots in six different directions. But this requires a very technical, tedious analysis of the evidence. For example, if David W. Mandick, MD, PhD, he's got a PhD in physics and an MD and is board certified in radiation oncology, which is a treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy, had not been an expert in the analysis of X-rays, he would not have been able to go into the National Archives and discover that what was supposed to be the original autopsy X-rays on JFK were not, but were copies or fabricated X-rays to conceal which had been patched in the case of the lateral cranial X-ray by a massive patch in the back of the head to conceal this huge defect that was about the size of your fist when you double it up, and to add a 6.5 millimeter metallic slice in the case of the anterior posterior, something which even the pathologist conceded they had not seen when the X-rays had been taken originally, because their principal task, they said, was to remove metallic fragments from the body, and if they'd seen that, since it was so conspicuous, they surely would have sought to take it out. But the choice of weapon that the conspirators used to frame Lee Oswald, this Mannlicher Carcano, this World War II weapon, which was known as the humanitarian rifle for never harming anyone on purpose, cannot fire high-velocity bullets. It only has a muzzle velocity of 2,000 feet per second. And yet the Warren Commission report, the autopsy reports, and all that said Jack was killed by the impact of high-velocity bullets. So we have the simplest possible exoneration of Lee Oswald. His weapon can't have fired the bullets that killed the president. This is Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the boy wonder here Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, unless, of course, he's off in Morocco trying to track down one of those alleged suicide hijackers. I think, David Ray Griffin, among others, has reported a half a dozen or more of these guys are alive and well and living in the Middle East, and Kevin's on a mission to track one of them down. I expect him to be successful. In any case, we'll find out soon. He should be back next week. What I'm doing today is talking about the 9/11 research community and how it can be subjected to manipulation. And what's fascinating to me is about the way in which research is being channeled into a very narrow groove debating very actively about thermite and excluding, viciously attacking those who wander off the reservation and seek to explore other hypotheses, no matter their capacity to provide a more adequate explanation of the extant evidence. And the evidence we have here includes the rate at which these buildings were destroyed, the thoroughness of their destruction, the degree of pulverization, the massiveness of the demolition of the World Trade Center itself as a totality over and beyond the North and the South Tower, leaving Building 7 as a completely separate matter since we know that came down by classic controlled demolition at 5:20 in the afternoon. We have the odd phenomena in Building 6, that huge scooped out gouge with all the material missing. We have Building 5 with all these cookie cutters, as many as 50 of these weird incisions in the buildings. We have Building 4 half there, half missing. Building 3, huge gouge. We have the non-functional damage to the bathtub. Very strange. If 500,000-ton buildings came down on that bathtub, it would have shattered. There would have been massive flooding beneath the lower Manhattan. The subways would have been flooded. So would have the PATH train tunnels. Indeed, one wonders if there was supposed to be all this molten metal, why it didn't flood into the PATH train tunnels or the subways, too. Not to mention, if there had been a functional incapacity of that Hudson River and water had come in, there would have been massive steam explosions interacting between the pools of molten metal and the water, which didn't occur, which implies either the water wasn't there or the molten metal wasn't there, or both. And indeed, Judy Wood, who has been doing the most active research here and who has the highest qualifications of anyone in the 9/11 research community, with degrees in civil engineering with a focus on structural engineering, in engineering mechanics, which is also known as applied physics, and in materials engineering science, which is probably the discipline most directly related to understanding what happened to the Twin Towers, for example, has observed the photographs of a big rainstorm, you know, that occurred within a week of 9/11. And while there had been a mist hovering over the site, that mist is missing when the rain is coming down, which is very odd, because if there were molten metal, it ought to have increased because of all the steam, but it hasn't. For that and other reasons, including photographs where we see in the foundation of the South Tower, we see workmen walking down, climbing down into the wave sub-basement at the bottom, and there are pools of water which are percolating or steaming, and the men are walking around. There's a lot of evidence that raises questions about the very existence of molten metal, which those on the other side have taken as a given. And I say, well, this may be like the JFK assassination. If most of the evidence in that case was phony or faked, we got to assume that a lot of the evidence in this case is going to be phony or faked. And I've already pointed out other examples, such as a group of workmen peering into a cavern that's supposed to be molten metal, where that molten metal would be at around 3,000 degrees, and the heat coming out of that cavern would be melting the flesh off their faces. I mean, you'd never think of putting your face over the spout of a tea kettle when it starts to whistle. And that's only 212-plus degrees. We're talking about 3,000 degrees. So there are various forms of evidence here that appear to have been faked or fabricated. Then you got that fountain of metal coming down from the building, the corner of the South Tower at the 80th floor. There may be alternative explanations for that. We'll get there. Now, the way in which the government in general managed 9/11 information was to focus on the Arabs, on the Islamic hijackers, and allow intensive investigation in a narrow band, which included the 9/11 Commission report when it was eventually forced to get there. And they, without doubt, had a predetermined conclusion, and they tailored their evidence to support a predetermined conclusion. Anyone in the 9/11 community who thought something was wrong with that approach was ridiculed. They were made to feel ridiculous. They were castigated. The government described them as fools, as kooks, as loony. So I would think they would learn something from the way in which, you know, research can be managed. The government did it to the whole 9/11 research community, and now it's going on again within the 9/11 research community to contain or constrain research on hypotheses that may be far more important and explanatory of what actually happened on 9/11 than the range of conventional explosives hypotheses involving thermite and thermate. And this extends to the 1,400 toasted cars. There are all kinds of phenomena here that look to me inexplicable, and to others inexplicable on the conventional hypothesis. And here's something that these activists who want to keep it simple don't understand, okay? they don't understand is that if it was unconventional weapons, that's a more powerful proof of governmental complicity in these events, because the only way these could have come into play here is if the military-industrial complex had a role in all of this, the military-industrial Defense Department intelligence complex. So if it was non-conventional modes of demolition involving lasers or masers or plasmoids or mini-nukes, it had to be the government. There's no other way to get around it. So they ought to part, you know, take this factor into account. Thermite and thermite can be purchased on eBay. They're conventional and they're available, but they don't appear to have the capacity to explain the phenomena. So we're in this area of third stage of scientific investigation. First is puzzlement. You don't understand something, doesn't fit into your background knowledge. Then speculation. Identify the full range of possible alternatives that might potentially explain it. Even if some of them look implausible on the outset, for example, natural phenomena, could it be an earthquake or a typhoon or a tornado? Then you have to get to the stage of adaptation. You have to lay out the full range of data to be explained. And here's where Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds have been so dazzling in laying out this huge array of evidence that has to be explained. Then you look at the hypotheses. Could it be these natural occurrences? Well, no, it's too selective. Well, no, it can't be. Would it have done damage to all these other buildings? Well, no, so it's not a typhoon, or it's not a hurricane, or it's not a tornado. Then you look at conventional. Can conventional explain it? Well, what can conventional explain? Well, that's a very good question. I mean, how much of this explosive would be required? And if it's thermite or thermate, then it operates at very intense high pressures, high temperatures. We'd expect there'd be lots of beams that show the cutting effects of this thermite-thermate if it actually was used, because that building had 47 core columns in the center, 240 external. Presumably, there are going to be hundreds, thousands of beams that are going to show the effects of thermite or thermate. Just as if the claim is about to be made that it's coming out of this one little corner of building 80, well, if the whole building is loaded with thermite or thermate, why isn't it coming out all over the building? How can it be so selective? It raises the question, maybe there's something about that floor, that 80th floor, that was peculiar, such as the hypothesis that it was a Fuji Bank floor that was covered with batteries as a backup source of energy in case the power went out so they could preserve the records for all their clients. That's not an unreasonable thing. Lead has a very low melting point. That could be lead coming out of that one source. Why not all over the building? If this building is packed with thermite or thermate, why isn't it coming out all over the building? So what can be explained by a thermite-thermate? The NTSB investigated 236 samples of steel. They found all but three had not been exposed to temperatures of over 500 degrees, and of the three that had, they hadn't been exposed to temperatures over 1,200 degrees. So where's the steel that's been exposed to temperatures in excess of 3,000 degrees because they've been affected by thermite and thermate? It isn't there, so far as I can see. At least I haven't found it. Now, in managing what's going on in terms of research to keep us away from hypotheses that might have a higher probability of explaining the evidence, these high-tech weapons, a group has been involved to enforce a kind of groupthink, and that's the issue to which I shall now turn. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. When I'm discussing the way in which research within the 9/11 community has been constrained by members and organizations within 9/11 research community, just the way in which the government constrained research on any alternative hypothesis than that 19 Islamic fundamentalists hijacked these four aircraft by using Fox News and government propaganda and spokespersons for the federal government, including the vice president, the president, the national security advisor, and the secretary of defense, to castigate and ridicule those who took exception to the government's official account. Now, within the 9/11 community, we have a 9/11 community official account, which is that thermite and thermate was used to control it. And there's a group that's enforcing that in an analogous way to Fox News and the federal government's mechanism. And that includes 9/11 Blogger. And it apparently also includes Loose Change, that has forbidden the discussion of certain topics, and even Jack Blood's forum, which I find very disappointing. And those are a few of the many forums that seem to be channeling discussions. So if you want to talk about alternative hypotheses, no matter how much more probable they might be in terms of offering hypotheses that could explain the evidence, when you actually become familiar with all the evidence, they're being ruled out. Just as discussion about anything other than hijackers was ruled out by Fox News and the federal government. So I want to congratulate those who are on the other side here for operating in the same oppressive manner as Fox News and the federal government in seeking to constrain research about 9/11. is completely authoritarian, unscientific. It's a form of disinformation, and principles who seem to be playing a role here in channeling research within these narrow boundaries include Stephen Jones, Alex Jones, Kevin Ryan, and Jim Hoffman. Now, these suggestions came from a listener, but she's absolutely right. She's dead on. She added the name of Webster Tarpley. But Webster, to me, is a more difficult case because, for example, in his book, Synthetic Terror, in the second printing on pages 242 through 245, he talks about the possibility that some kind of high-tech directed energy weapon may have been involved in bringing down the building. And subsequently on page 270, he talks about the possible use of a chemical laser to destroy the plane in Pennsylvania. Well, that's a broad attitude, even though I've heard him express concern with me for pointing that out. It's meant as a compliment to this guy. He should not be seeking to restrain research on high-tech weapons as possibly having been involved here, especially when the probability that they can explain the evidence is overwhelmingly greater than the conventional explosives and thermite and thermate can do it. So I say we've got a problem here because the research community is being manipulated just in the way in which the population as a whole was manipulated, basically because Fox News and the federal government realize most Americans don't have a lot of time and aren't critical thinkers, so they could easily be taken in if you repeat a false story over and over again. Within the 9/11 community, which is mostly made up of critical thinkers, scientific reasoning is being manipulated. So if you don't buy into the account, this very narrow channel of research involving thermite and thermate, then you're supposed to be unscientific. Well, I'm here to tell you that that ain't so. And I want to illustrate it by this last paper from Stephen Jones, Revisiting 9/11-2001, Applying the Scientific Method. If anyone touts the scientific method over and over again, it's Stephen Jones. And his model of science, as I've explained before, is seriously flawed. And the serious flaws in the model lead you not to realize how much you're being channeled by his discussion. And I'm going to try to explain that now, talking about his paper. I'm going to go through it, but I'm going to have to be very efficient. Now, even in the introduction, he talks about this is supposed to be serious business looking at what happened to the WTC. And, of course, that's an exaggeration because he's really only looking at the Twin Towers and then occasionally Building 7. He's not talking about 3, 4, 5, and 6. So he uses a misdescription right off the bat, just as he did before when he said, you know, what destroyed the World Trade Center, when he's really talking about three buildings. He says, this is not just nutty fringe science or conspiracy theory. It can be rejected without even considering the data. Well, how can you reject a theory without considering the data? That's the only basis you have for rejecting theories, if they don't satisfy the data, if they can't explain the data or they're contradicted by the data. So already he's being abusive here in channeling. Then he says there's a need for scientific scrutiny, as I hope to demonstrate. My colleagues and I now feel we have sufficient data to conclude the conclusion of that the collision of jets with the towers, the two towers, are not sufficient to explain the complete rapid collapse. And here's talking about collapse of both towers and WTC-7. Is that news? This is his latest paper. Is that news that the impact of the planes with the buildings isn't sufficient to bring them down? Hell, WTC-7 wasn't even hit by any plane. So is this supposed to be news? This is this man's latest paper. It's published with great fanfare. Everyone is swooning out there. I can't offer the least criticism on 9/11 Blogger, what's going on here, without being crunched. This is ridiculous. This is absurd. This is unscientific. This is irrational. This is channeling. This is trying to defeat research, not promote it. They says, we conclude that the evidence is compelling that the destruction of the WTC buildings involved planted cutter charges, such as explosives and incendiaries. We will consider this evidence. Well, who hasn't known that? When Eric Hofschmidt published Painful Questions, if it wasn't obvious then, I can't imagine when it would have become obvious, because his work is so compelling and the evidence is so overwhelming, and he doesn't seek to conceal the dustification, the pulverization of the buildings. Here, even the use of the word collision is dubious. So how does this paper begin? Background. He starts talking about all these publications he's done. Well, what's that got to do with this paper on applying scientific method to 9/11? It goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, telling about the glories of his past research. Look, this guy in his whole career has published 40 papers. Judy Wood has published 60 as an assistant professor. I published 150 articles and reviews and 28 books. So am I going to publish an article that starts off by explaining that I published 150 books and articles and reviews and start giving you my greatest hits? This is ridiculous. This doesn't go in a peer-reviewed paper. This does not go in a peer-reviewed paper. This is ridiculous. All this stuff is rubbish. Here's something fascinating, too. He talks about Luis Alvarez. Well, Luis Alvarez, very interesting, is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist from Berkeley. But Luis Alvarez got involved in 9/11 research. He claimed to provide a jiggle analysis of the Zapruder film that proved there were only three shots. And he got it published, but it wasn't in a peer-reviewed journal. And we have re-examined his research, and David W. Manick has published a paper in Hoax, the Great Zapruder Film Hoax, that demonstrates that he was fudging all of his data, that there were all kinds of jiggles all over the place. He was being very selective. So here's a case where Luis Alvarez, whom you take to be an outstanding scientist, was subverting his own work. He was publishing an irresponsible paper. It was unscientific. If it can be true of Luis Alvarez, my God, it can be true of Stephen Jones. And he gives us one, two, three, four, five pages of complete irrelevance. Now, I tell you, I have a huge amount of experience as an editor. I co-edited a famous philosophical journal, Synthes, for 10 years. I founded and edited alone a philosophical journal in cognitive science named Minds and Machines for 10 years. I continue to edit an online journal about the advanced research of the death of JFK at assassinationresearch.com. In the last day or so, I got a submitted paper. I picked out two world-class referees for it, for the journal on assassination research. And by God, we're doing it the right way. That's not being done here. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, and we're talking about a paper by Steve Jones that is his latest work, and yet it publishes nothing new, except, as I shall observe, there's some concessions here. If you read between the lines and you understand what he's saying, it's been widely offered and touted as a great accomplishment, but there's nothing new here. We didn't know years ago. In fact, this guy has repeated the same song and dance over and over so many times that I became completely frustrated with his claims to be doing serious research. It was obvious to me this was a degenerating research program who wasn't spawning new hypotheses, new experiments, new results. And he's been doing that for a year and a half now. Here he starts talking about scientific method. He says it's a process of observation, formulating an hypothesis, performing tests and experiments, and then publishing the results in a peer-reviewed journal. That's wrong. It's a process of puzzlement. We make observations all the time. I'm observing my computer. I'm observing my library. Is that science? No. It's puzzlement. You got something that stimulates or provokes the necessity to do research and figure out what's going on here. Can you just formulate an hypothesis? No. That's what the NTSB was doing. That's what the government was doing. They're trying to channel you to focus just on one hypothesis or a very narrow range of hypotheses. You have to look at the whole variety. If I haven't convinced you that now, I don't know how I could. Then he says perform tests and experiments. Well, it's really more than that. Like, he wants to perform tests and experiments on his one hypothesis. Suppose you had a test or experiment that tended to support the one hypothesis and conferred a certain probability on the evidence. Would that mean there wasn't another alternative hypothesis that conferred an even higher probability on the evidence? That's the flaw here. That's the blunder right here. He wants to focus on one hypothesis at a time. This is how the channeling takes place in the context of pseudo-scientific reasoning. Artificial constriction to a narrow range, in this case thermite, thermate, that's completely unacceptable from a scientific point of view. And for this guy to claim he's practicing the scientific method when he isn't is so offensive, I cannot begin to articulate my feelings about it. You've got to look at the full range of hypotheses, figure out if each of them were true as a cause, what's the probability they would bring about the effects that are observed. And then when you have sufficient evidence, the hypothesis that confers the highest probability on the evidence has the highest degree of evidential support, technically the highest likelihood. A hypothesis is preferable to another when it has a higher likelihood with regard to the available evidence. And when the evidence settles down, when it all, roughly speaking, points in the same direction, then you're entitled to accept the hypothesis with the highest likelihood in the tentative and fallible fashion of science, knowing that new research, new evidence, new hypotheses may cause you to reconsider and reject old hypotheses previously accepted, accept new hypotheses previously not considered or rejected, and so forth. This is a defective model of science. And putting it in peer review just means, in the case of this 9/11 journal, that he got a bunch of his buddies to rubber stamp it. I'm telling you, this is an unacceptable paper. This paper right here is not a publishable paper, but it passed a peer review in the 9/11 journal. And I'm telling you, I know the difference. I spent 35 years doing this kind of stuff. I'm an expert on scientific method. I have a PhD in the history and the philosophy of science. If you want to ask what criteria would justify somebody making these judgments, It's going to be their criteria, of their credentials, their background, their education, their publications, their research areas of expertise, the number of papers they've had published in peer-reviewed journals. Well, I probably had 50 more published in peer-reviewed journals than Stephen Jones has. And my area of expertise is scientific method. And I published all these books, of which Jones has published none. Now, this is ridiculous. To offer his view of science and why I go patiently explain it, and the research community is so close-minded they put their hands over their ears so they can't hear it. This is completely offensive, unscientific, authoritarian, manipulative, propagandistic. This is the official conspiracy theory. Well, we know all about that. On the next page, it's very interesting, 61. He's talking about the collapse of Building 7. He's got a fascinating photograph here on the right-hand side. We have Building 7 in the background, and it doesn't have any numbers for the photographs and no captions. That's completely unprofessional. That would not be acceptable in any serious journal. But what's fascinating about this photograph on the right-hand side is, where are the Twin Towers? They aren't there. They aren't there. There's no stack of rubble. They aren't there because they've been turned into dust. They've been pulverized. He wants to keep using the word collapse. How is that reconcilable with the evidence here of this photograph that appears in his own paper on page 61? That's ridiculous. But he talks about here about NIST, this one on page 63, that there have been restrictions imposed by the NIST, and he wants to be blunt here. He says researchers have complained there's been suppression by the Bush-Cheney administration on their studies and publications on global warming. Well, and of course they've done it with respect to research on 9/11, but so too have Stephen Jones, Alex Jones, Kevin Ryan, Jim Hoffman, 9/11 blogger, Loose Change, I'm sorry to say, in Jack Blood forums. I mean, it's ridiculous. If we want to find out what happened, we got to look at the whole bag of tricks, all the possible explanations that might apply here, and determine which has the highest likelihood as a function of the probability of the evidence given the hypothesis is true. And you got to make sure the evidence is authentic. Remember the case of JFK. Then we get the scientific method. What are the facts? What conclusions can we draw from them versus the political method? Here's a conclusion. What facts can we support? Well, as a skeletal, you know, bare bones kind of thing, this is funny and it's right-headed, except that facts don't speak for themselves. We are theorizing, we are thinking, we are conjecturing all the time. Karl Popper, great British philosopher of science, published a book, Conjectures and Refutations, one of the most important books in the history of the philosophy of science. He emphasized we're thinking, theorizing all the time. It doesn't matter whether you have the hypothesis first and the evidence later, because it's a relationship between the hypothesis and the evidence that matters when you assess the likelihood in that stage known as adaptation. And you don't get the explanation until you determine which hypothesis among all those fits the evidence best, confers upon it the highest probability. So it really, strictly speaking, doesn't matter whether you come up with the idea first or the evidence first, because you got to figure out the relationship between the two. And then he talks about truth and justice. At the bottom of 65, he's got a pitch for joint scholars for 9/11 truth and justice. What has that got to do with a peer-reviewed article? Those paragraphs don't belong there. And he falsely claims that we extended an invitation to NIST. That was Ed Haas, everybody. Ed Haas had that brilliant idea for the national 9/11 debate. Truth and justice didn't even exist. They had nothing to do with it. Here they're falsely claiming everyone in the truth community should know that. That's a grotesque abuse. Ed Haas deserves all the recognition in the world. I was the captain that put together the team for the great national 9/11 debate. Steve Jones had a peripheral role because I invited him to be a member of the team. Truth and justice did not even exist. How can they have claimed that they advanced that hypothesis? They talked about the Times or the WTC Towers. Well, Judy Wood has given the most elegant proof. The problem we have here is the NIST has 236 samples of steel, and they found all but three had not been exposed to temperatures greater than 500 degrees, and the other three not below 1,200 degrees. So Jones got a lot of data that doesn't make the same thing as the good science. He says NIST is ignoring a lot of data. That's not good science, but so is Jones. We got this 236 samples of steel that all but three have not been exposed to temperatures greater than 500 degrees, and none of the other three over 1,200 degrees. How is that consistent with the use of thermite that operates at 3,000 degrees or above? And then we got on page 68, he's talking about complete collapse here. He's still talking about collapse, but it was devastation, it was pulverization, so he's misdescribing the data again. Then we get to this molten material pointed out of the South data, and on page 69 and 70, he's talking about this molten steel and claiming it can't possibly be molten aluminum, and yet the experiments I've seen with molten aluminum that Judy Wood, for example, has presented appear to create the similar visual impression of molten steel. So not only that, but there seems to be a far more plausible explanation for why you have this molten metal coming out of that 80th floor would not come out from any other part of the building. And then we get to, namely, if there was those lead batteries on the floor, from the Fuji Bank building. And then on page 74, we he shows us results of an experiment with thermite cutting through some lead steel cup. But and then he talks about the toasted cars, but those toasted cars had all kinds of damage that haven't been accounted for. We haven't seen any experiments with toasted cars. And by the time we get down to the World Trade Center dust and these iron-rich microspheres, we're getting to the absolute heart of the matter. Now I'm talking about pages 77, 78, 79. He's talking about having discovered these iron-rich microspheres, which implies that the metal was once molten. But there are lots of ways that molten metal can be produced. Lasers, masers, plasmoids, mini nukes can produce molten metal. So the fact he's got molten metal in some dust does not prove that, in fact, it was produced by thermite or thermate. And he says, if we search for possible prosaic explanations, and there's channeling again, prosaic explanations, that means conventional energy explanations. That's begging the question again. That's channeling research into a very narrow groove. And he talks about assuming thermite cutter charges were in fact used to cut through steel. And this is Jim Fetzer, your host of the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where we can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays if he's not off in Morocco tracking down alleged suicide hijackers. I'm talking about Steve Jones' latest paper, and I'm critiquing it from the point of view of scientific reasoning and whether or not it meets the standards for a peer-reviewed article. I hope it's becoming clear that it does not. There's nothing new here, and in fact, there's several evasive aspects that I now want to emphasize. He talks about, now I'm on page 78, that if you assume that thermite cutter charges were in fact used to cut through steel, then you would expect to find both steel and thermite residue spherules, little tiny balls. Could these droplets be due to molten aluminum alloy from the jet striking rusty steel and or other office material to somehow generate the iron-rich spheres? We performed experiments with molten iron poured onto rusty steel, then onto crushed gypsum and concrete on the rusty steel, and observed no formation of iron-rich droplets at all, nor any sign of vigorous chemical reactions. Well, here he's giving you the impression he's actually doing a thorough job of considering alternative hypotheses. But this is like the NTSB saying, well, they did a thorough job and discovered the pilots were at fault because they excluded the plane being the problem or the weather. He's not talking about the serious alternative explanations for having these effects of these little globules or little blobs of molten metal. A high-temperature directed energy process would produce them, too. And he is not even considering them with when they would indeed, in my estimate, have a higher probability of bringing about those effects as thermite. So he's simply excluding them because he's channeling our reasoning and he's not admitting it. At the bottom of page 78 is the most peculiar paragraph in the entire paper. He says, one can estimate the implied amount of thermite needed to generate so many iron-rich spheres in the WTC dust. Then he talks about the sample. He makes a calculation of how much dust. If the mass of the WTC dust was about 300,000 tons, then he says, listen to this, then the iron-rich spherule content would be on the order of 10 tons. Well, that's talking about how much iron content of these little globules is in the 30,000 tons, 10 tons. Then he says this is a very rough estimate based on one small sample, and this sample is too small to be taken seriously, and it's only provided to give an idea of the amount of thermite-type reactants and products which may be involved here. Well, he didn't say that. And yet in the next sentence he says, I mean, there's an ambiguity here between whether we're talking about the amount of spherule content or the amount of thermite required to produce this amount of spherule content. He's talking as though he's talking about the amount of thermite necessary to produce it, but it's ambiguous. There's something wrong with this paragraph. He says this is a very rough estimate based on one small sample, and he's only provided to give an idea of the amount of thermite-type reactants and products which may be involved here. Then listen to this. An investigation well beyond the scope of this paper would look for purchases of aluminum and iron oxide powders and sulfur in multi-ton quantities prior to 9/11/2001. That supports the interpretation that what he's actually saying here without saying is that 10 tons of thermite was involved. 10 tons of thermite. 10 tons. That's a whole lot more than the, 3,000 pounds of RDX that he was suggesting could have been used on the buildings in his previous great article. Okay, about how did the buildings, World Trade Center completely collapse? when it didn't collapse and he's only talking about the North and the South Tower. Then he finally gets around to talking about barium nitrate, and by the time you get to the final page, he's admitting that what he's talking about now isn't actually thermite, but something he's calling a thermite analog, which so far as I know is never actually defined. And he admits that thermite, which he now calls TH3 as an analog of thermite, contains sulfur and barium nitrate when he's redefined thermite. Now he talks about thermite as defined here. Well, this barium nitrate containing thermite TH3 is the military thermite that he's been using in the past to demonstrate the effective force of thermite. So when you see that, you know, that's really a thermite grenade being put on the top of a car and you see it melt through the engine block, that includes barium nitrate. No barium nitrate has been found in the chemical residue analysis of the dust, either by Steve Jones or by the U.S. Geological Survey. They haven't found barium nitrate. So this isn't actually military version thermite that he uses to demonstrate the power of thermite. It's a bait and switch. It's like showing you a Ferrari and then selling you a Volkswagen. You got this thermite that will do it and cut through these blocks, but he hasn't shown that thermite analogs will do these things. And now he's slipping in this notion that it's a shell game. And here's on page 80, here's a stunning sentence where he says, in the middle of this page, MEI has conducted energy dispersive spectroscopy, EDS, on minute traces of residue, identifying the presence of these chemical elements. The results, coupled with visual evidence at the scene, provide absolute certainty that thermite reaction compounds were present, indicating the fire was deliberately set and not of natural causes. Well, there's a missing quotation mark there because you got an end quote but not a preceding quote. He does give a citation, but nothing in science is proven with absolute certainty. So if you want to know if somebody is being unscientific, it's when they affirm that something is the case with absolute certainty. All science is fallible and tentative and subject to revision. So this is a very unscientific claim. And then he talks about the NIST was asked, did the steel tested for explosive or thermite residue, the combination of thermite and sulfur called thermate slices through steel like a hot knife through butter? Answer, NIST did not test for the residue of these compounds in the steel. And I say, was the steel here tested for the use of lasers, masers, plasmoids, for example? Because the combination there can produce similar effects. And the answer is Steve Jones did not test for lasers, masers, or plasmoids. And yet they could produce these little globules, these little metal, and what is it, metal particles as well. He certainly hasn't ruled them out. It's just like NIST claiming that they've explained it was the pilots were responsible without considering that it could have been a small bomb, a gas canister, or some kind of high-tech weapon. He never even goes there. Those are the nutty theories. We're being channeled. We're being directed. And here's the key sentence in the whole paper. I will simply say in this paper that iron aluminum-rich spheres are seen in both the WTC dust and in spherules produced in thermite-controlled reactions. Okay? That just means they're consistent, that if you had thermite-controlled reactions, you could get this kind of effect. It doesn't rule out the possibility you could get that same kind of effect with innumerable other causes such as lasers, masers, plasmoids, mini-nukes. None of that has been ruled out by this research. So here I have a grossly exaggerated claim about what's going on here. And then at the end there's a paragraph on footnote 52 where he starts talking about the Constitution and building cooperation, sharing and caring. What's that got to do with this paper? That's no part of a scientific paper in a peer-reviewed journal, not if it's properly done. But it's the kind of paper that can show up in a journal that poses as a scientific journal and feigns peer review when he's actually using his buddies to get attack pieces out there, the attack pieces that are actually sleights of hand, intellectual sleights of hand. And I got to tell you, that's the story here. There's nothing new in this paper. It doesn't establish its conclusions. It has all kinds of features that disqualify it from being a properly reviewed article. It doesn't establish a conclusion that shows that thermite or thermate were even used at the World Trade Center. There's all kinds of evidence that one would expect to be available that appears not to be, such as large numbers of steel beams that show the effects of thermite or thermate, or large numbers of steel beams that show the effects of heating up to temperatures in excess of 3,000 degrees. It's not there. It doesn't appear to exist. Now you can say, well, NIST shipped off, or Giuliani had all this stuff shipped off. Yes, well, we should find some residue. Where is the proof? This is one of those cases where the absence of proof isn't proof. The absence of proof isn't proof in this instance. And all he has shown is that there's a consistency between the use of thermite and these little tiny dust in this one sample or two samples he got from this woman's apartment. And I dare say to you, no serious scientist is going to rely on the results of one or two samples. Certainly the U.S. Geological Survey didn't do it. And I'm terribly troubled to say that just as the program listener who suggested that what we're talking about here is a channeling of research, and it's within the 9/11 community, and it's just parallel exactly to what Fox News and the U.S. government has done to try to channel research into the official story of 9/11 hijackers, which was then substantiated by all the 9/11 Commission report and all that, where they claimed to have all sorts of evidence. As critical thinkers, members of the 9/11 community weren't taken in. But they aren't so sophisticated in scientific reasoning. Now they're being taken in by a narrow channeling within the 9/11 research community. And that narrow channeling is being enforced by 9/11 blogger, by loose change, I'm sorry to say, by a jackblood forum, but especially by Steve Jones, Alex Jones, Kevin Ryan, Jim Hoffman. This is very distressing, very distressing. If you care about truth, you have to follow science. You have to entertain all the possible hypotheses. You have to look for the ones that could confer the highest probability on the evidence. You have to become familiar with the evidence. You have to sort out the authentic evidence from the inauthentic evidence. That has not been done here. None of that. Thank you for listening. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.